This is Spectator Radio, the Spectator's curated podcast collection.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk. I'm Olivia Potts, the Spectator's cookery columnist.
And I'm Laura Prendergast, Spectator Live's food and drink editor.
And this week we are delighted to be joined by Adrian Charles, broadcaster and writer. Adrian, thank you so much for coming on Table
Not
Talk.
Not at all, always a pleasure. How long is this? Because I can talk for at least the next 6 hours about
it's
food.
It's exactly so. 6 hours long.
Right, okay, good.
Works very well. Excellent. So Adrian, you grew up in Birmingham.
Yeah.
What was food like when you were little?
Well, it was slightly different for me because my mum's Croatian. So she'd come from Yugoslavia, as it then was, in 1958, I think, when they got married. And I was born in 67. So, I remember, actually, I was talking to her the other day and she was saying she went out looking for garlic and walked the length of the Soho Road in Handsworth and just couldn't find any garlic and just didn't know how to cook without garlic. I think when she finally found some, the whole family was absolutely horrified with this noxious substance she'd found. But it's interesting because even then, the sort of the Asian and Afro-Caribbean influx obviously hasn't happened in terms of stuff like that being widely available. So I think to a very early age, I think my first very dim memories of my mum's mom feeding me, because she'd come over for 6 months of the year while it was freezing cold in Zagreb. So I remember her making mashed potatoes. I remember eating mashed potatoes. One of my few memories from the house we lived at in Birmingham, a place called Quinton, where we left when I was four, then went to a place called Hagley, which is where everybody went. If you did good in Birmingham, you ended up in Hagley or Solihull or Sutton Coldfield. So it depends which direction you went in. So we went to Hagley. So I just ate really well throughout sort of my childhood. It's the kind of thing you don't realise until you've got kids yourself and you try to feed them, or you're trying to feed yourself. Not so much the cooking, because I think you can have a knack for that or not. It's just the thinking about it and just having something different on the table every day. I completely took for granted. I thought it was totally normal that you'd had seven different meals on 7 days of the week. Now, on Sunday, there'd be a roast. And then on Monday, it was probably my favourite meal of the week. There was always the cold cuts of meat from the Sunday and mashed potatoes and gravy and some kind of green beans or something. That was my favourite meal of the week. That made, you know, Monday's always grim when you're a kid, isn't it? Because the school week started and everything. But I just remember eating that on a cold winter's night. And I still kind of love that. And several years on, after a lifetime of fanatical meat eating, I stopped eating meat. I had an incident with a lamb, which I had to sort of kill and then eat. And I haven't been the same since. But, you know, that's the meat meal I miss most, those cold cuts.
And did you find yourself going to friends' houses and getting fish fingers and oven chips? Or?
Yes, I think there was a bit of that went on, because I always went round for tea to friends' houses and it kind of be beans on toast and stuff like that, which was fine. I mean, we had that, you know, we had that from time to time. But then, you know, actually, I mean, I didn't stress about that. That was fine. I could eat it and enjoy it, but something different. But, you know, when they came to mine, they'd be like, my mum would always make kind of thinned soup, so everything, it was like one chicken had last 3 days. I know it sounds a bit of a cliche, but if you're raised in, you know, post-war Yugoslavia, then everything was pressed into service. So, you know, obviously the chicken carcass had to be made into broth. And so you make this clear soup and you'd put these things, I think in Croatian, it's probably a German or Hungarian word, it's called knedle, which I've just taken for granted. They've been bobbing around in every soup I've ever had made by my mum. And what it is, it's like semolina.
Like
it's
a dumpling?
Sort of, yeah. It's semolina mixed with egg and oil and mix it, and then you poach that in the thing. And it's just, I don't know. And I thought, you know, my parents are getting old. My mum said, look, you know, I said to my mum, look, you better tell me how to make this thing now. I need to, you know, I need to know to sort of preserve these things. So that's known as, my kids, interesting, or, you know, well into their teens now, my brother's kids, that's known as baka soup, because baka being Croatian for grandmother. So baka soup is known as that kind of thin soup with those things bobbing around in it. But, you know, that was odd for kids growing up in the West Midlands who come round for tea. They'd be looking at it and go, you know, what on earth is this? So I think that was probably taken off the menu eventually after a lot of suspicious looks.
And did your mum teach you to cook as well as the soup?
Actually, so there was no need for me to cook, but I sort of had an interest in it. I remember there was a cookbook, it was the Hamlin Kids First Cookbook or something. It was like an A4 size hardback with like cartoons about how to scramble an egg and stuff like that. And I remember looking at that, and I've seen that in some cooks' all-time favourite cookbooks. That's been in there. So I wasn't the only one who had it. So I must have had some kind of interest in sort of basic cooking. But it wasn't until I went to university that in the second year when we were living, I was living in Cricklewood on Shootup Hill in a flat with three other blokes. There were two Geordies there. One of them was a bit of a sort of socialist worker type. Another guy, his mate, wasn't quite as left-wing. And then there was the poshest person any of us have ever met before or since, who's now a High Court judge, actually. He'd just come from boarding school. We never met anything like him. So we all set about feeding ourselves. So he'd be poaching salmon, which is in a big... He had one of those big, long salmon poacher things.
Fish kettles.
Yeah, fish kettle, that's right. His father had caught on the... What is it? The team in Hampshire? What's the salmon river in Hampshire? Anyway, whatever. So his dad will have caught that, or he'd have caught it going over the weekend. So it would be all. Like, I remember the Geordie going, "What the hell's that?" Just this kettle. It looked like a metal coffin to him, or something. You might bury a baby in, or something. But then me and my friend Jed, one of the Geordies, we got some cookbooks from home, and we just love cooking. I remember I'd be on the phone to my mum saying, "How'd you do this? How'd you do that?" So we had some sort of great feast, and there's still pictures I've got at home somewhere of stuff we made. Made a bacon and egg pie once. It's the first time we'd made sort of pastry. We made curries, and I think that's where it kind of started. And then I just sort of massively into it. I just love getting recipes out the papers. I kind of miss that. Doesn't happen so much anymore. And I kind of almost miss cookery books as well because the internet's just taken over. I wanted to make col canon yesterday. And I thought, I've got a recipe in my book at home. But then, even before I got home, I thought, well, I might as well, you know, I was on the tube looking on my phone, and there's like 600 different ways of making col canon. So once I'd sorted through all them, popped to Sainsbury's on the way home, and then it was sort of almost done.
I read somewhere in an interview that you thought that a university food might be a good seduction weapon, was the phrase used.
What happened to me was, I was always the kind of bloke. I had loads of girls and friends, and this is for the dating podcast, which you may or may not do. But I was just bloody hopeless. So I ended up having loads of girls who were friends, and I sort of didn't. It never went any further than that. And there was all this, you know, there's that cliche about, you know, women supposedly love blokes who can cook and blokes who can make them laugh. Well, you know, I could cook and make them laugh, but I never had sex with any of them. And then. Yeah, and then, you know, then 20 years later I got rich and famous, and I was fighting them off then. You know, so I don't know what that
Maybe
says
to
you.
Maybe we do need to start this dating podcast. Yeah. Pillow talk. The spin-off from
absolutely.
Table talk.
But so I had many a woman left my flat with, you know, mascara, laughter running down the face, a bit groaning stomach full of fine food and everything. But then, anyway, they got well fed.
What would you cook on a date? Or what would you have cooked on a date then?
Oh,
it might be a slightly different answer.
I would. There was a thing, actually, a friend of my friend's, wife, and I live in Brighton, but an absolute staple was something called mustard chicken, and it was dead easy. I don't even think there was onions in it. You just cut fingers of chicken. She showed me how to do it. Just quickly brown some sliced chicken breast, and then I think it was just a case of having cream and whole grain mustard, but that took some beating. That did. I mean, it looked like a lot of effort had gone into it, but it's sort of embarrassing. I don't think it had onion or garlic in it, from what I remember. So that was pretty much a staple. Also, I've always been obsessed with. I love putting stuff in the oven in the morning, cooking very slowly. And this is something I miss with meat, actually, because meat lends itself to that kind of thing, and not cooking meat. You know, I could put a shoulder of lamb in on a very low temperature in the morning and then come back and work 7 or 8 at night, and it'd be there and ready to rumble and the house smelled great. You can't really do that if you're not cooking meat. But I was always doing something like that. I remember there was one recipe from the Birmingham Post I cooked. This was right around the time we were doing the finals. It was beef in Guinness with orange. And I find this, I look at recipes and think, oh, yeah, that's going to be good. And you really look forward to cooking it. So, you know, I assembled this, and it was like putting, I think that's what appealed to me, put it in for 8 hours. Oh, magnificent. So, like, I put it in, and then we got back. I was living in the flat in Kensington at the time. The flat smelt great and everything. He said, it's not ready yet. It's only been in for 7 hours. So me and my mate went to the pub, and some other friends were coming around later to eat it. And we got back from the pub. Oh, it smells fantastic. And I remember it was in a big Le Creuset thing. I've got the lid up. and literally it was like tarmac. Like baked the bottom of this thing. I mean, it ruined the pan. I know, like a crime. We left. I know what I'd done. I'd mixed up. I think the recipe was wrong, but I'd mixed up my Fahrenheit and centigrade or something. No. So I put it in at full heat instead of it should have been at barely 100 or something. But I remember I just trying to salvage the pan. I just poured water in the pan, and then a couple of bits of charcoal rose to the surface. I remember my mate saying, "Oh, they're survivors. They're coming. They're rising to the surface." Oh man, it was funny. I kept that recipe for old time's sake. Actually,
And what about this lamb? I mean, what happened to the lamb that inspired you to become vegetarian?
I was an absolute meat fanatic. I ate a lot of vegetables as well, but I loved eating meat, buying meat, cooking meat. I was friends with all the local butchers. I got to know Heston Blumenthal very well, actually, and I was a bit of a devotee of his way of cooking it, which is basically, you know, if beef's cooked when it's reached 60 in the middle, then don't put it in at 200, because by the time you got it at 60 in the middle, the rest, the outside will be, you know, just completely will be cremated. You know, water boils at 100 degrees, so it would just dry out. So I cook it a long time, and I just love doing that. I mean, one of my colleagues when I worked at ITV Sport, Andy Townsend, we were working in South Africa at the World Cup in 2010. You know, which is obviously an absolute meat fest in Johannesburg. And Andy said to the assembled one night, "I'm not going out for dinner with him again. It's like going out for dinner with Freddie Flintstone, because I was just getting, you know, a whole pig and great ribs and everything." It was but that was kind of the background to it. But then I made a documentary about religion for the BBC, and I was in Istanbul for Eid. And I was with this really nice family. They were great cooks, actually. They ran a restaurant. So I had to spend Eid with them, which involved taking the lamb to be slaughtered, basically. And I was kind of a bit squeamish about it. But, you know, it didn't really bother me. I'd always lived in fear of my kids or into food, them turning vegetarian or anything. Oh, what a pain. And if I had a vegetarian coming around for dinner, I thought, what am I going to do? And all that business, which I now realise is ridiculous. But anyway, I was with the two daughters from this family who are in their 20s. And it's on the suburbs of Istanbul, which is huge, but there's kind of a huge sort of open air sort of abattoir. I don't know how else to describe it. And, you know, there are hundreds of lambs and dozens of bulls there to get slaughtered. I remember the bulls being on the way there. There were bulls standing up on the back of low loaders, sort of an open bed truck. They were standing there sort of chained down with plastic shopping bags over their heads with just the horns poking out. So I think that was just, if you put the bag over the head, they didn't, you know, they wouldn't move. Anyway, so we got to this place, and it was almost as far as your eye can see. There was all the livestock was over one side, and then it was like in a field. From a distance, you could have thought it was like a big sort of village, English village fete. It looked a bit like that with the marquees and stuff. But then we went and got the lamb they'd bought. I remember the lamb was called whatever, I can't remember its name now, but it was in Turkey, you know, a Turkish name, and they'd called it Courage. I thought it was going to need some under the circumstances. So we go and collect this lamb and pay the bloke, and then take the lamb over to the slaughtering place, which had a queue. It was sort of backed up. There was, you know, the butchers were there with the big knives waiting for them, and they were bringing them in about four at a time, saying the prayers and then slitting the throats. And I just remember this, leading this lamb over, and the girls from this family were just sort of stroking its head and stuff. And I started to feel a bit funny about it, and then there was this queue, and the lamb started struggling. So they tied it, some bloke came and tied its feet together and lay on its side there behind about six other lambs. And I remember this Turkish girl said, "Oh, the lamb is very nervous now." And I went, "Really? I can't imagine why." But I'm not the kind of animal lover who thinks animals are super intelligent or anything like that. I just don't believe that. But I don't necessarily believe this lamb knew exactly what was going to happen. But that lamb knew something bad was about to happen. I mean, you know, no shit, Sherlock kind of thing. But it wouldn't take much to work it out. But he was pissing itself. And there was just this wild look in its eye. And then the time came, we took it on. I thought, hang on, can I actually watch this? And then I just heard the prayers happening behind, and I just watched the lamb. And he did something with the knife, and suddenly it had happened. I hadn't quite registered, and his head was to the side, and there was blood just pumping out into this drain. So that was that. I was kind of a bit shaken, and I sort of kind of had to look away then. But then the sort of I went off somewhere, and then the lamb is then taken away to have it to be skinned, and the lamb put in a heavy plastic bag for us to take home. And then the two girls came, walked down with this plastic bag, which they could barely hold between them. It was quite heavy. And so then I, trying to be the gentleman, I took it from them, and I just grabbed it, and I put it over my shoulder, and like a sack. And then I just felt the warmth of the dead animal, you know, through the plastic against my back. And then we got to the house, and then it was, you know, we were eating it 2 hours later. It came with a Fawlty Towers type dome thing on it. It was the big flourish. Off it came, and there was this cubed up lamb meat on top of rice. So I had to eat, and I got it down. And then we went off to Israel next on this filming trip, which is, you know, very, you know, big on meat as well. And I kept managing to get the meat down, but then I just couldn't, hang on, why am I forcing myself here? And so then I just stopped, really. I never kind of looked back. I mean, I cooked meat, funnily enough. I cooked some lamb for somebody last night. It didn't bother me cooking it or something. I just thought, it just can't pass my lips anymore. I've just done my time. I've just got to... Yeah, I mean, there's bits of it. I mean, I cooked this lamb shank last night and I could, you know, it was all I could do to stop myself stripping to the waist and eating like a caveman. But I managed to resist the temptation. And actually, it's been an education in cooking as well, because you kind of have to work harder if you're not cooking meat, because with meat, meat's the main event and then there's the other bits around the side. Well, if there's no meat, then the other bits around the side have got to work harder. And there's many more flavours going on there, I think, as well. And you've got to be a bit cleverer with herbs and spices and stuff like that. So, you know, I've enjoyed it, I must say. I have the odd moment where I could demolish a pork pie or something, but generally it hasn't bothered me.
Would you ever go vegan?
Well, I sort of basically vegan at home, and then, but I just, it's just too difficult elsewhere. And then the trouble is, none of my friends are even vegetarian, let alone vegan. So if we go out, I can't go out again and just eat another mushroom stroganoff or whatever. And there's still, you know, often the kind of places we go, there wouldn't be much. I eat a lot of Indian. And I still can't quite make my mind up on the ethics of... I still can't quite justify eating eggs and cheese, even though I do from time to time, but I try and avoid them. I mean, the alternatives are generally very good now, I think. Some of the cheese I like and stuff, but I'm basically vegetarian, sort of nearly vegan.
You're also a big football fan.
Yeah. There's normally some drink involved, although I just did a programme about drinking, so I can't have a quiet pint anymore because everyone seems to want to talk about sort of drinking to me. But there's a tradition around West Brom, it's my team in Birmingham, or Birmingham, the Black Country, on the border between the two. There's a lot of big pubs run by Muslims or Sikhs generally, and they do like fantastic sort of chicken, you know, but fantastic Indian food. So people come, all the away fans come in as well. It can turn in a bit of a scrum, but they're enormous, these places, and there's just massive naans coming out and massive chicken and lamb kebabs and curries and stuff. So people just, there's a big culture of going in, you know, or ordering these big naans and chicken and just sort of feasting and drinking beforehand. But again, that's meat, so I don't do too much of that. But I just found a great little pub in Hockley called the New Soho Tavern, which is my favourite place on earth now. They do this fantastic sort of vegetarian tikka and vegetarian sort of kebabs, which is kind of meat substitute stuff, seitan kind of stuff, which I really like. And the curries are fantastic. The naans are fantastic. And it's not too busy and everything. It really is my place. Although the last game I went there, it was packed full of Birmingham City hooligans with about 60 police outside. So I should have left, really, but I couldn't face not eating eating that food. So I just braved it and didn't get killed and eaten myself, mercifully.
Too good to pass up.
Yeah.
And what about cooking at home? You obviously enjoy cooking for other people.
Yeah,
and
you've
learned about vegetarianism. If it's just you on your own, do you cook for yourself? Do you take
time
over?
I can do it. As cooking is the only thing I can do mindfully. It's the only thing when I'm actually focused on one thing. So I find it incredibly relaxing. Although, to an extent, I can cook when I should be doing other stuff. I will hatch some plan in the morning for do something that involves piddling around all day with something. Yeah, generally, I won't make a massive effort if if I'm on my own, I might make some soup or something. I don't know. It's more about cooking for other people. My daughter, my eldest daughter's at university, and she really likes food, but she's a hopeless cook. She's not interested. But the younger one's really into food and likes cooking as well. But she'll call me often at lunchtime and say she's coming around for tea and text her food order in exactly what she wants. So, and actually, they went vegetarian. It's about the only thing they've ever followed me, and I don't think it was anything to do with me or not. I don't know, but neither of them eat meat. And I used to take, I got a place in Wales, and I'd take like a dozen of them down in a bloody minibus and just do nothing but cook. You know, I'd turn into my mum, like I'd be laying the table for breakfast before I went to bed, doing those kind of, I'm running the dishwasher 6 times a day. But actually, I was just sorting some stuff out at home, and I found a load of little thank you letters from my older daughter's mates when they were about 13 or 14. Aww. We went down, and they were saying, we really like this and this and this. And it was, and I just put them on my kitchen door. So that's what it's all about. And they, in fact, they came back from university. Because they all went off to university last September, and they came back, and they all got together at my flat, and they said, oh, can you get your dad to cook this, this and this? So, oh, all right then. So I said, well, can you cook it, leave it on the table, and then F off out, because we don't want you here, we just want to eat your food.
Well, talking of your cooking, we've got a loaf of bread.
Yeah,
and sourdough.
I started getting obsessed with making sourdough, which I know is a terribly middle class thing to be doing, but I just became a fascination. I've had the same starter going for 5 years, and obviously you keep replenishing it, and I have messed around with that flipping method for ages. My brother comes round, he just says, why are you always messing around with slop? I'm always messing around with a starter and measuring it and stuff. And actually, in the end, I've now cracked it. But I'm disappointingly, it's not through intuition. Most dishes you end up cooking well, it's because you've worked out a way of doing it yourself and you modified it, you got your own secret way. In the end, I just found a book called Sourdough Imaginatively. And then quite a complicated without being that laborious when you got the hang of it. But I just followed it to the letter. And I can make a whole range of sourdough loaves now, which isn't quite as satisfying as having developed them myself, because there's some very good-looking smarty-pants Hoxton types who've done this book with stupidly arty pictures in it. But almost annoyingly, it does work. But you've got to sort of start it 2 days before. There's quite a lead time. So you've got
it's
to
a commitment.
Yeah, it is. You've got to refresh your starter, then overnight, then make the leaven first thing in the morning, and then mix it and then knead it every half an hour for 2 hours, then put it in for the first ride, take it out, shape it, put it back in the thing, then it's got to rise for another 2 hours, and then it's got to go in the fridge, and you leave it to the following day. So, you know, it's a 48 hour operation, but you know, it's sort of constantly on my mind. So I think I started making that on Sunday and then finished it on Monday and then baked it yesterday. So
it looks delicious.
Oh, so exciting. Yeah. Talk about the other treats that Adrian's brought us. Yeah.
That's a thing.
Homestyle, yeah.
Ivar. So that is I think countries in the Balkans have all got a version of it, but it's a thing in the former Yugoslavia. And the best stuff by repute came from Macedonia. I think that's made in Macedonia, which was the most southern of the former Yugoslav republics. But it's kind of thing everyone's gran's got a recipe for. But basically it involves grilling or barbecuing loads of aubergine and loads of peppers and then skinning them and then cooking the flesh for about 5 or 6 hours with oil and a little bit of salt. And that's it, and it cooks right down. It's kind of one of the things, once you made it, you then put off eating it because you're so sick of it. It's like molten lava almost. It occasionally spits at you, end up with little burns all over your face. But there's a place in Shepherd's Bush where they're from Vukovar, which is on the border between Croatia and Serbia. And one of them's Serbian, one of them's Croatian, which appeals to my sort of love and peace tendencies. But they stock that particular one, which is the best one I've come across. That on bread, or actually that with anything, or actually.
So you'd recommend? Could you have that with your sourdough?
Yeah, just put it. Yeah, you can just put that on the. Whenever I buy that, I end up just sitting it and just eating that the thing with a spoon. It's just, it's just too easy.
I mean, have you married your loves? You've obviously got sourdough there, which is fermentation, and you love beer.
Yes, that's true.
Do you your own brewing?
No, like most people of my age, when you're obsessed with underage drinking at the age of 14 or 15. It was some loophole in the law back in the day. I feel like somebody's granddad telling you about this, but, you know, you could never get in a pub if you weren't shaving, as I wasn't. You know, you struggle to get in a pub before you're 18. But every Boots had a home brewing section. And you can buy all the stuff you needed to make sort of 40 pints of, you know, 40 pints of ghastly tasting beer, which
put you off for life.
Well, we could put you off for life. So I've never gone much beyond that. I try and eat fermented food, and I've really tried to acquire a taste for just sort of sauerkraut with everything. Mm. Though it's good for you, I find it hard.
Yeah.
It's just hard to love that stuff. But since I did this program, I drink sort of a lot less. It used to be about. It was all that drinking when you're not thinking about it. So you'd be cooking, and you know, by the time you sat down, you'd had the best part of a bottle of wine while you were cooking. I've just tried to sort of avoid that kind of thing and just have a couple of glasses.
Well, you said, I think maybe during the programme, that drinking responsibly is the most boring phrase in the English language.
Do you
now drink responsibly?
Yeah, I do. I wouldn't use responsibly. I'd use an even sort of wankier part of my language expression. I came across, which I've become a bit of a devotee of, is mindful drinking. I think that's really important. I think it's really important to focus on the drinks that you really want. I mean, I was getting up to drinking without getting drunk, without causing any obvious problems, you know, without, you know, any consequences, really. You know, I wasn't fighting anybody, or, you know, I could get up in the morning and go to work, but I was just sort of drinking every day, never going mad, never staying up late. But a couple of pints every night, maybe a glass of wine, you throw in a lunch plus a proper night out. That gets you up to 60 or 70 units very quickly. But what I thought was, it suddenly occurred to me, I did a calculation on the back of an envelope, that if I added up all the drinks I've drunk in my life since I was like 15, that would the line would be about 4 miles long. And I thought, right, that's a lot of drink going through your system. But what was worse than that is that if I really thought about how many of those drinks I actually wanted, stroke enjoyed, stroke needed, you know, I bet it's not a quarter of them. I mean, it's about a quarter. The rest is just drinking for drinking's sake.
Yeah.
You know, just because you're out and you think you might as well, and, you know, your friends are still out, you don't want to go home, but you do want to go home, but you don't feel as if you can go home. You know, or just Sunday lunchtime, you know, you end up drinking a bottle of wine over lunch, and then the afternoon's just a bit of a woozy kind of mess. So I just really try and think, you know, what do I really want to drink? And a big thing for me, because I'm generally kind of thirsty, is that somebody just gave me a tip, said just don't drink for thirst. So particularly in the summer, if I just went to the pub, I could be at the bottom of 3 pints of lager straight away, just sort of quenching my thirst. So just drink plenty of water before you go out. I mean, it sounds a bit boring and absurd, but just little tricks like that. And also drinking weaker beer. There's a German trick, something called Bier Sauer, where you drink, it's sort of a shandy but made with soda. So it's kind of half lager, half soda. Now, that actually isn't as awful as it sounds, you know, because you kind of get used to that taste, and it's basically half the unit, so.
Well, we're recording this, it's Lent still, it's Easter next weekend, and you converted to Catholicism.
Yeah.
And then in Lent 2015, you went to a different church every day.
Yeah. That was I'd have different mass every day for Lent, and I wasn't drinking either. So looking back, I think I might have been having a nervous breakdown. But it was really fascinating.
Have you given anything up for this Lent?
Actually, I undertook to give up swearing, but then that didn't last till 2 or 3 days. So, and I tried to practice mindfulness, so I took something up, which I think is really important. Important to take something up, but I sort of kind of believe in sort of mindfulness, just sort of slowing things up and just not panicking about all the annoying things that have happened in your life so far and fantasizing about all the terrible things that could happen to you in the future. If you do that all the time, if you're not living in the present, you will go mad, which I've felt I have done from time to time. I might do my mindful cookery book, actually, how to just lose yourself in cooking. You know, it's one way of sort of distracting yourself.
It sounds like a lot of the cooking that you enjoy most is savoury cooking. Do you have a sweet tooth?
I don't have a sweet tooth at all. And that's whenever I'm cooking for people, I never look forward to making the pudding so much. I've got a couple of simple standard ones that I can crank out, but I don't get excited about it, really. Liz Kershaw, I used to work with, a broadcaster, she gave me a great one once, which I've just done for years and always got away with it, which is just like chocolate chip cookies dipped in an instant coffee with Tia Maria in it, right? Ooh. So you dip them in and then spread them at on a dish, and then put a layer of bananas, sliced bananas on top of that, and then put whipped cream on top of that with chocolate flakes on top. Now, I mean, look, it's obviously calorific, but it sort of rises above itself. You know, that I've never had any complaints with that. So I'm sort of slightly blessed with not having a sweet tooth. I think it'd be a bit of a nuisance if you've, you know, just piling all those calories in all the time.
Well, Adrian, thank you so much for joining us, and we are very much looking forward to enjoying this loaf of bread
you
brought us.
Break your teeth, do you get health insurance here?
I think we do.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us on the Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories, and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website. La pauvre fleur disait au papillon sieste.